We want to start tonight talking about 1493. One of the first talks we had here was with Matt Ridley, talking about ideas having sex and about the great benefits of trade and what that does when ideas mingle. And this is really about sort of plants having sex across the ocean. And it has just amazing impacts. I mean, it's stunning, this thing called the Columbian Exchange, which is what happened after Columbus discovered the New World. And could you just start off by telling us what the Columbian Exchange was and why it matters? I know that's a whole book, but just...
Thank you. There's this slightly odd thing where I want to talk to the man here, but then I turn my back on you. So what I'll do is I'll talk to John and then periodically feign this kind of thing in a sort of robotic way.
I won't be
first. But anyway, the premise of the book, which will save you $30, is... That if you step back and think about the reason that Columbus is important is that, as you probably know, 200 million years ago or so, the world consisted of a single giant landmass. Scientists call it Pangaea. Geological forces broke it up, forever separating the continents and forever separating the ecosystems on those continents. And what Columbus did was, in effect, recreate Pangaea. All of a sudden, his ships and the ships that followed brought over huge numbers of creatures from over there to over here, and return vessels brought huge numbers of creatures from over here to over there. And the result, this ecological mixing, was a convulsion in the history of life and the biggest event since the death of the dinosaurs. And the argument I make in the book is both of this is interesting in and of itself, but it also played a big role in human history as well.
Now, what were some of the things, for instance, I'm just talking about a few of the events. For instance, just the Industrial Revolution might not have happened the way it did without this, for instance.
Right. Yeah. If you want to have an Industrial Revolution, turns out you need three raw materials in addition to the human knowledge involved. And one is you need steel, which basically comes from iron, and iron's all over the place. You need fossil fuels. Fossil fuels are all over the place. And the third thing you need is rubber. You need something to prevent, these metal pieces from flying apart when you have a steam engine. You need belts. You need tires. I don't know if any of you have ridden the old kind of bicycles that didn't have tires, but it's not an experience that any man would enjoy. Let's put it that way. And so it turns out that rubber, these elastomers, are not really widely distributed. And in fact, the very best ones are found in two species of trees that are only in Brazil. Hevea brasiliensis and Castilla elastica. And so in the 19th century, as lots of nations in Europe and elsewhere industrialized, there was a great scramble for the Amazon, to take over the Amazon and to corner the supply of rubber, which led to all kinds of havoc.
But as you said, that the Industrial Revolution wouldn't really have happened the way it did without this rubber.
Right. You need the rubber to, for instance... if you want to transmit the motion of an engine to something else, you need belts, and belts are made out of rubber. If you want to have wheels, you effectively need some kind of tire, and those are made out of rubber. If you want to have steam engines, you need gaskets. I think we know from the Challenger what happens when a gasket doesn't work, right? And so all of this is you need some kind of rubber. Now, there is synthetic rubber, but it wasn't invented until later in the 20th century. And as it turns out, it's not nearly as good to this day as natural rubber, rubber from trees. And so all the rubber in airplane tires, for example, anything that really needs stress all of airplane tires are made out of 100% natural rubber. The sidewalls in your radial tires, 100% natural rubber. The serpentine belt in all of your cars, 100% natural rubber, and on and on and on. It's about 45% of the world market.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's some disconcerting news in the book for locavores, for people who, now you yourself like to eat local food, you say, but you also realize
hobby.
You're a fraud, though.
Yeah, I'm a fraud, yeah. I mean, it's my hobby, and I live in Amherst, Massachusetts, which is kind of like the Berkeley of the East Coast, right? You guys know about it? Yeah. And so we have our own, farmers markets, and we're very earnest. And I'm extremely earnest as well. I'd like to just say I fit right in. And so we have our garden. I like my garden, and it gives me this feeling of home, and, I'm capable of really being boring on the subject. But the point is it's completely bogus. And the reason is that there's absolutely nothing in my garden, or I think in any garden in New England, that originated within 2,000 or 3,000 miles of New England. I mean, I grow tomatoes, which come from Mexico. I grow lettuce, which, you know, came from Europe. I grow garlic, which came from the Middle East. You know, you just go on and on and on, and there's absolutely nothing in my... It's this cosmopolitan, exotic, modern object, and that is pretending to be this sort of traditional, homey artifact, but it's, in fact, as space age as anything you can imagine.
Now, we've talked a lot here about, in previous discussions, about the sort of, you know, trade in general, and,
yeah.
And there are people who promote more trade, globalization. There's a lot of free traders in this room. But now, you talk in the book a lot about both the benefits. Now, the obvious benefits are that Italy has tomatoes, and yeah. that China got peppers, from this Colombian exchange once all this started happening. But you say that there are also that sometimes the free trade advocates underestimate the costs of globalization in this sense?
Well, there's two things I think that are going on I talk about in the book. The first is, if you think about the free trade that's described in economics textbooks, you know, it's always between willing buyers and willing sellers. And in fact, states use trade all the time to agree, you know, for self-aggrandizement, for the purposes of power. And then, you know, what happens then is much less free economic exchange as a means of gaining things for this or that political entity. And the examples of that throughout history are just enormous, starting with the fact that which I talked about for a long time, is that China, for example, had this, as you learn in the textbooks, had this trade ban. And what it really meant was that the government sought to monopolize trade 100% for the court and control all the benefits for itself, so that any kind of trade with China wasn't, you know, in any way like the kind of stuff that we talk about free trade. And of course, this was the largest and most sophisticated country in the world for centuries upon centuries. And the second thing is that often people aren't aware of everything that they're trading, so that the people who brought the potato to Europe, we have no record of it. They had no idea that they were bringing something that would transform European agriculture for the good. Similarly, the same people who brought the potato blight to Europe, which had enormous and negative impact, killed a couple million people in the famine of 1845, also had no idea what they were doing. So the accounts in free trade, basically free trade is this enormous force for good, but it's also enormously complicated to fully quantify how much of that good is there. It's basically the argument from these two reasons. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, now, in looking back at the history of this, I mean, and in terms of the environmental downside of this, because...
Well, there's an upside, too.
There's an upside and a downside, but you talk about malaria traveling across the ocean and all these organisms and Indians, you know, smallpox, of course, you know, coming in with the Colombian exchange and kind of a Holocaust here in the Americas among Native Americans. Now, I mean, looking overall at the environmental impacts, which kind of countries have managed it better? I mean, what kind of governments have managed sort of the environmental, controlling the environmental damages better, do you think?
It's interesting. I mean, you know... You okay there? Okay. It's interesting. You know, this is something I've been thinking about as I look at this. And, you know, all of these free trade brings these unexpected, trade of all sorts brings these unexpected environmental consequences. And the nations that do, in general, a better job of managing it are democratic nations. The nations that do the worst are places like China, where the legacy of the Colombian exchange has been catastrophic, and the way that the Chinese are dealing with it is kind of mind-boggling. I could go on and on and on. I went to China 8-9 times for this book, and at the end I thought, wow, this country's screwed up. I mean,
well, how did that happen?
What
ways did it screw up in terms of handling this?
Well, what they did is when I went to junior high school, we didn't learn any geography. I don't know what we learned. I don't think we learned anything. And it was like a progressive school, you know, and they told us about our feelings and so forth. I mean, it was like when people have denounce these progressive schools, and there's like a caricature, and you say it couldn't be that bad. Actually, that was my school. And so Highland Junior High School was just, we didn't learn anything. And so I didn't actually look at a map until I was like 25. And... if you look at the map of China, you know, so consequently it struck me fresh. You know, I'd look, damn, you can see all this stuff there, you know. And if you look at the map of China, about half of China is this desert, right? There's no lakes there. There's no big lakes. They don't have a Great Lakes. They don't have anything like that. And there's only these two major rivers, the Yangtze and the Yellow River. And the rest of it is these sort of dry hills. And there's only two like flat areas where you would want to grow anything. There's the North China Plain, and then there's a little one in the middle of the country where they grow a lot of rice. And so you have China with, what, 20% of the world's population, something like that, 7% of the world's above ground freshwater, and the crop they want to grow, and what everybody wants to eat, has to be grown in swimming pools. I mean, it's completely insane. And this is like a one-sentence summary of Chinese history, right? This incredibly, due to the fact that people are geniuses, they're able to sort of pull this off. And so they're actually able to give people rice and so forth. But it's like they're barely doing this, considering it's impossible. It's sort of amazing they did it at all. And then about 1600, big dramatic change when these crops come over from the Americas. And the two big ones are sweet potatoes and maize, which is what people call corn outside the United States. And they come, and at that point, almost all of China's population, the Han population, is concentrated in the east. And suddenly you get these crops you can grow in dry lands that are the first sort of crops you can get a lot of calories from dry land. And if you go into the western desert, it's unbelievable. They're growing corn and stuff that it's like farming a beach. It's unbelievable. And so what the Ming Dynasty does, and then the Qing Dynasty does, and then the Mao Dynasty, because it goes right up in the 20th century, is they take basically whole villages and they shove them out west and they say, cut down the trees on these dry slopes and plant sweet potatoes and corn, and by the way, kick out the indigenous people. And so just like we're doing, they're doing. There's this parallel movement. Go west, young Chinamen, and kick out the indigenous people, kill them if possible, and plant your crops. And since the Chinese have never done this before, they make beginner's mistakes. And so what they're told to do is terrace these things. And so it was right out of the 20th century. It's amazing. And so they take all these dry hills and they cut these terraces out of them. And there's hundreds of miles of them in northwest China and in southwest China. It's kind of wedding cake effect. And it turns out that terraces actually require sort of sophisticated engineering and knowledge to build them, because otherwise if they're made out of dirt, they fall down when it rains. And so occasionally, even in these dry areas, it rains. And if you stay in the villages, which I did a few times, when it rains, everybody's up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and you hear as they get out their hand tools and are trying to patch up these things. And of course, you can imagine how well it works. And so after these things are about 100 years old, they just fall right down into the steep hills. And so pretty soon, China, as a result of this, has the world's worst erosion problem. It's amazing. It looks like our badlands. If you go on the tourist buses, they'll say, look at these ancient terraces that our people have been farming for thousands of years. It's just complete nonsense. They're like 100 years old, right? And so they cause all this erosion. And then it turns out, this is really getting long-winded. Is this
not okay? Good.
Well, it turns out that there's this really interesting bit of physics in rivers. While the rivers, because eventually what happens is the dirt, the sediment, goes into a little creek, which goes into a slightly larger river, which goes into a slightly larger river, which ends up in the Yellow River or the Yangtze River. And while they're in these steep hills, the water's turbulent, and so all the dirt stays in the water. But as soon as they get to these flat areas, the North China Plain and these areas where people are trying to grow something like rice, the river flattens out and it slows down, and the stuff precipitates down to the bottom. And there's a lot of it. And so when it precipitates on the bottom gets high, builds up. And pretty soon you have this bizarre phenomenon where the bottom of the river is higher than the surrounding land. And there are places in China where the Yellow River is like 30 feet above the surrounding land. And you don't have to be like a genius, a PhD in physics, to realize that having a giant river 30 feet in the air isn't really stable, right? And so the answer is floods. What happens, and massive floods from this. And so I went to the Chinese State Meteorological Bureau, and you have this tremendous bureaucracy in China forever. And one of the things that happened is there's all these counties, and they had to have a county report every year and give it to the central government. And so the Chinese Meteorological Bureau had gone through all these county reports for 600 years and made these flood maps of China. And you can just see them starting in the late 18th century and just getting huge, huge, huge floods. And I was looking at this, like nothing in our history. So I said to one of the meteorologists, how should I explain this to Americans? It's so weird. Look what's happening. And he said, just tell them we had a Katrina per month for 100 years. So they, what happens is the dynasty just wrings its hands. There's no way for local people, there's tons of evidence that local people knew exactly what's going on, but there's no way for them to communicate, you know, to the state. The state didn't care. So you have all these flood refugees going around. Flood refugees from the southeast cause something called the Taiping Rebellion that kills 20 million people. It's just a mess. And it ends up that, you know, at the end of the 19th century, small groups of Europeans are able to push into this giant country that used to be the world's most sophisticated and push them around. And it has an awful lot to do with this idiot legacy of environmental disaster, which goes right into the 20th century. And so now the Mao dynasty, as I sort of nastily like to think of it, is saying, oh, wow, we have to do something. And so what do? They go to these villages, the same farmers who have been pushed around all this time, and they say, after you finish your harvest, you get to work for us for free. And what you get to do is plant trees, because we want to, and we're going to take part of your land, and you're going to devote it to trees. And so they, of course, don't like this. And so what they figured out is you have to go out into the hills and you dig these pits, which is a lot of work, and then you plant the trees. And it's a lot of better if you don't have to dig the pits year after year. So they cultivate northern pines and other trees that are not going to do well. And so they deliberately plant, you know, the same trees in the same pits year after year after year. And I met these guys, they said, oh yeah, I've been doing 6-7 years. It just gets everything done faster. You know, I don't have to do this. I get to sleep. And of course they do. I mean, there's no recompense for them. And so when you probably now and then will read accounts about these fantastic efforts are being made in China to reforest the country and, you know, reverse these environmental degradation. And you should take it with like the biggest grain of salt that you have available.
Now, you know, speaking of environmental degradation, you recently appeared with Jared Diamond, the geographer who's written bestsellers about these great environmental, you know, collapses, now, as you've told me, the most of these things he writes about, in fact, you know, serious geographers have serious qualms about it. Is that right?
I like the geographers. When I was a kid, I always wanted to be an explorer, and geographers are as close as you can get. And so I like them because they just want to find out what happened, generally. And so so I was sitting with a table of them, including this sort of famous guy named William Denovan, who's one of the great geographers of the Amazon. And Jared Diamond gives a talk, and it's about environmental determinism. Is that a phrase you guys know? Yeah. And basically, the environment dictates what's possible for us. And so when you supersede these environmental limits, the nature's going to come and crush you down.
And, like Easter Island and the Greenland.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's these collapses. And to geographers, this is like fingernails on the blackboard. And the reason is, well, in addition to it being wrong, this idea has a terrible history in that in the beginning of the 20th century, geographic textbooks, and you can read them, you know, would say stuff like, oh, people in Latin America and Asia will never amount to anything because you can't think in a hot climate. And, you know, this kind of stuff, which is just ridiculous and, you know, racist and all the other stuff. And so they're kind of embarrassed by it. And so they really don't want to stay clear of those kind of arguments. In addition, they don't actually believe that it's impossible to think in a hot climate and that sort of stuff. And so Diamond gets out there and he gives this full-throated defense of this idea in this modern form. And this guy, Denovan, who is this famous geographer, turned to me at the end and he said, well, long time since I heard that.
No, Diamond's idea is that there are these environmental limits and that we really, and that all these societies have collapsed because they've exceeded them. And the moral is, of course, that we are now about to exceed ours unless we follow
We have to put on our cardigan sweaters and turn down the thermostat and eat lower on the food chain and reduce the human footprint and all that stuff. And it's sort of hard to know where to start, actually. But you know, one of the things that you wish is that, I mean, I'm not an economics genius, but I did take economics 101. And, you know, the impact of human activities is not on the environment. It's not like if I go to the opera, you know, I walk uptown to the opera, that is registered as GDP. And it's registered just as much as if I, you know, make my money out of I don't know, poisoning something. And they obviously have dramatically different impacts. Yet you can read this whole thing, this whole literature about how GDP equals, you know, the growth necessarily equals destruction. Mm-hmm. And this is just the start of that kind of, what seems to me, economic illiteracy. Plus, you find yourself in these arguments, like as I had discussions with him. He said, oh, you can tell that there is no way that the people in Australia were ever going, you know, the original inhabitants were ever going to develop boats because there were no islands to see from there. So why would they go? And so they're perpetually doomed to never to have trade. And then I thought, well, wait a minute, Australia's big. So they didn't, if you're sitting there, it doesn't look like an island when you're, and it doesn't look like a little tiny desert island when you're there, right? It looks like this continent. And the people in Western South America, I mean, it doesn't look that different. And there aren't a lot of islands there, but there's huge amounts of shipping up and down and forth in pre-Columbian America. But his suggestion is that, you know, that, anyway, it goes on. Also, the Chinese never became, had sea power because there are no ports in China, he wrote, which was kind of astonishing if you've ever been to a Chinese port. But also, it's kind of astonishing because China has like a zillion boats and has always had a zillion boats, right? So he goes, anyway, sorry to hammer on this.
No, but I remember Julian Simon, the economist, was kind of my mentor, talking about Paul Ehrlich and the other sort of ecological determinists. And he liked to quote, I think it was Henry George, the economist, saying that both humans and jayhawks eat chickens. But the more jayhawks, the fewer chickens. The more humans, the more chickens.
Right.
That the humans do different things.
Right. So. We're a weird species.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, there is, I mean, in fairness to these guys are coming, from the idea that, I mean, one of Darwin's great lessons is that human beings are, you know, animals like other animals, and it's a great truth of biology. But, and so they basically say, well, like zebra mussels, you know, my understanding is the zebra mussels come, they proliferate across Lake Erie, they eat everything that a zebra mussel can eat in Lake Erie, and then they all die.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because, you know, zebra mussels don't say, let's invent farming, but, and so they say, well, human beings are like zebra mussels, or what have you. We're, you know, they're fundamentally identical. And the argument from a social science perspective or an economics perspective is, well, we're not, ultimately. And I think that's the basic difference, is that if you come from this biological perspective, you have this idea, you know, between you, John Tierney, and me, and a paramecium, you know, it's just we're sort of bigger, but not any different.
Yeah. Well, Paul Ehrlich, the great ecological and doomsayer, he's a butterfly specialist.
Right.
And he used that knowledge to basically, forecast.
Yeah, we're butterflies. Except less attractive.
Right, exactly. Now, do we want to take some questions from the audience here? Or,
sure.
Okay.
While I've got the mic, tell us something about methane hydrates and how they're going to solve the world's fuel problem and address the problem of geopolitical disruption.
I was incautiously told them I have a piece coming out in the Atlantic Monthly about methane hydrates. Do you know what those are?
There was just an article on National Geographic.
Yeah. So methane hydrate, the idea is that the sediment comes off the land and goes into the ocean at the continental margins, and then it trickles down to the bottom. And there it's eaten by microorganisms that generate methane. Just like if you walk past a swamp, you know, there's these bubbles of methane that pop up. And so they generate the same thing. But the water down there, you know, at 1,000 feet or so, is cold, and there's a lot of pressure. And under those circumstances, what happens is methane and water react together and create this kind of, it looks like ice. And it sits there in the sediment, and there's just incredible amounts of it that have built up over the millennia. There's some estimates that there's twice as much methane hydrate as there is all other fossil fuels combined. So Japan, which is really, really tired of giving all of its money to the Middle East, has been working on mining these things. And it turns out that you can essentially use a variant of fracking technology. It's called horizontal drilling. These things are in these horizontal belts, and you can take a mine go down there and then turn sideways, kind of like an anime drawing or something, and sort of, you know, a Roadrunner drawing. It wriggles through this, and you can warm up by shooting steam in there. The methane then escapes, and they just ran their first commercial test of this thing. They got 4 million cubic feet of methane from the Nankai Trough, which is, you know, not far from Nagoya, just a couple weeks ago. And the U.S. has been investigating it since 1982, and the argument I make in the article is that there is just a lot of this stuff, and even if most of it is inaccessible, a small fraction of a big number is still a big number. And what it will mean for us is less important because we have, through fracking and, you know, other sources of natural gas, but for a nation like China, India, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, much of Africa, all of which have methane hydrate deposits, would mean the chance to not have to shovel money towards the Middle East and other OPEC nations. And those nations, you know, we're not talking tomorrow, but the day after tomorrow, face a kind of defunding. And there obviously would be geopolitical ramifications.
If I could follow up, if you could kind of walk us through where the methane hydrate deposits are. I mean, we know the oil's in the Middle East, but where are the methane
hydrates? These are all along the continental margins of most of the world.
Pretty much everywhere?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's easier to say where they aren't than where they are. And so there's tons of them, for instance, off of West Africa. The big deposits in the, are in the Arctic. For the United States, are in the Arctic around Alaska. And then there's an area of, they think it's about 175,000, there's a sort of a California-sized area or something like that in the Gulf of Mexico. And there's the argument is that there's roughly 3,500, 4,000 oil and gas wells in the Gulf of Mexico now. Many of them are drilling through methane hydrate to get to the conventional deposits. It makes a lot of sense to adapt them to fracking technology as the conventional deposits are exhausted.
Yeah, well, got the mic. I wanted to ask you about China, although you mentioned fracking. So, in particular about China, we've been reading a lot about this terrible air pollution in Beijing. It sort of stains the Chinese image. More broadly, of course, for the last several years about China, we've been subjected to the idea that just as Japan in the late 1980s was supposed to dominate the world within about 15 years, we've been reading the same thing about China, that at least China is much bigger than Japan in terms of population, so maybe it has a better chance than Japan had. But what's your two reactions? First of all, to the air pollution problem in China, which just when you read about it in the Times, it sounds appalling and implications they can't do anything about it. And what's your broader view about whether China is going to be the dominant country of the world in about 20, 25 years?
China's obviously going to be a very important country. It's a fifth of the world's population. So, I mean, it should be, right? So, you know, I guess I have a little different feeling about this. And, I mean, from my perspective, one of the great things that's happened in all of our lifetimes is that hundreds of millions of people in Asia have been lifted out of, in the last 30, 40 years, lifted out of destitution into, you know, something much better. Same thing for Latin America and parts of Africa. It's just, you know, an enormous change. When I went to high school, what was it, 40% of the world was malnourished or something like that, and now it's like 8%. I don't know if those are exactly the right numbers, but they're roughly the right numbers. So it's a huge, huge change and a huge, great thing. In China's case, it's complicated by the fact that there's been enormous environmental damage, and the sort of normal mechanisms by which people could say, "Hey, you know, you're screwing up my water. Hey, you're screwing up my air." In a non-democratic society, that people just don't have the ability to protest in that way, and so you get really strange things. I was telling John at lunch, I went to this city in northwest China, close to the edge of the Mongolia, Inner Mongolia. It's right by the border there. And there, the Great Wall goes through there. And I thought, oh, great, I'll get to see. If you go to see it by Beijing, it's all reconstructed. I could see what it really looks like, you know. And so with my friend, we walked over there. And the idea of the Great Wall is it was all crumbly, but still you could see it. Is that there were towers every third of a mile or so, and people could signal. You know, you could wave a flag and say the Mongols are coming or whatever. And so I thought, oh, cool, let's climb up, one of these towers. And so we climbed up the tower, and the air was so dirty we couldn't see. the tower was at 30, and you know, and I thought, wow, it's weird. And I picked off my glasses, and there was like black specks all over them, black carbon from this. And you realize, and then when you take a shower, you know, even though we just walked a mile or something like that, it was like we were like these extras in a coal mining movie, you know, the water pouring off of us. So it's really unbelievably dirty. And from my perspective, China switching to natural gas is like a great thing. The black carbon we know is everything we find out about it is worse. And so these are huge issues for China. But the real limitation, I think, for them is water. They've been mind-bogglingly careless about water, and I'm sure this group here would have something to say about why that was, the lack of privatization and so forth. Basically, the central government controls all the water, and people just do really nutty things about it. I could go on and on and on about it, things that I saw with my own eyes. That tell you that I just don't know what they're going to do. You know, people are—they're already starting to do things like the city of Tianjin has spent about $10 billion replumbing the whole central city to have gray water, used in it. And then I think it's the world's largest desalination complexes in northeast China. Now, of course, they're fighting with each other because the people in the desalination wanted to sell their stuff to Tianjin. So they have really serious problems to overcome, and I think it's going to slow down their growth a lot.
So this is a question for both of you, and it's about sort of the disconnect between economics, the environment, energy, and evolution.
John.
They all begin with E, right? Right.
John. I have the answer already.
Go all right, but it goes back to the question of limits of growth, and Darwin was very influenced by Malthus, and free market, and so there's this paradigm problem. At some point, entropy, energy,
and epistemology.
So I want you both to speculate. John, you can go first. But the disconnect between environmentalists are probably more evolutionary Darwinian.
Environmentalists
economists don't care crap about Malthus.
Well, it's surprising how many economists still actually, you know, subscribe to some of this idea about resource scarcity, that, you know, whenever there's a commodity thing. But there is this basic thing where ecologists look at the world and see these finite ecosystems. They study animals, and animals do reach limits, and one species wins and the other doesn't. But humans are just fundamentally different. And I think if you look at the history of, you know, back in the classic text in the 19th century was a book by William Jevons, is that called The Coal Question. And he looked at this thing, and he was very scientific and said, you know, we have a finite amount of coal, and Great Britain's and the, you know, greatness depends on coal, and we're going to run out. He looked at the graph, it was very simple, and he was a little bit different than today's environmentalists in that he said, you know, we should think, should we save it for the future, or should we just indulge it all and have one last great, you know, party here? And he also recognized that it was this coal that made our society great, that we couldn't have had all this culture and wealth of the last century. And it was kind of a reasonable thing to think then. But now, we look around, and we have more energy now, just thanks to nuclear energy. I mean, we have enough energy in the hydrocarbons and everything to last for millions of years. And if you have energy, there's nothing to stop you, I think. And we can grow enough food to feed, you know, population many times the size we have. So I don't think there are meaningful limits to growth. And when you look at the problems that seem so catastrophic today about global warming, I mean, just versus 30 years ago when there was, you know, concerns in the 60s that we'd all starve to death, there wasn't enough food, we'd freeze. These things now that maybe the ocean would be, you know, several feet higher, maybe the air be warmer, these could be problems, but they're not, you know, deal breakers at all. Well, it's wrong for humans. I mean, we're going to move to Mars, and we'll do all these things. So, that's. I mean, I just think with energy and food, with enough energy and food, that what?
How about drinking water?
I think there's plenty of water. I mean,
but
you could recycle it,
water.
Right? I mean, there's all this water in the ocean, and you just have to price water. The big problem is it isn't priced most places. If you
price it, people will conserve it. And, but I'll let, you can disagree.
No, no. I think that the issue is that, you know, our species does these amazing things, but we're not very good at governing ourselves. And government is like this, you know, it's interesting to read about and learn about the governments in the past. And, you know, there's this enormous rate of improvement in almost every other sort of material quality of human life. And then you look at government, and and I realize I'm preaching to the, what?
Religion
and government, they're sort of like this usually. And so I feel like, you know, that every time I feel really optimistic, then I look at something the government has done, and I want to shoot myself.
Yeah.
And I know, look, we should not exaggerate. The one of the things that really struck me when I was in one of the times I went to China, I went for the in 2011, I think it was, there was a World's Fair in Shanghai, and so the Chinese government decided to clean up Shanghai, and they took several thousand factories that had been at the edge of Shanghai on the unbelievably aptly named Poo River, and said essentially, you go further up the Yangtze. You know, you relocate yourself a couple hundred miles out of the sight of the tourists. And so with the collusion of local governments, they just kicked people out and put in these factories and just heedlessly drained the water table so much that some of these cities in a space of a decade, had actually, the cities had sunk, you know, by almost a meter. And it was just, and the buildings were all tottery and so forth, and they drained the aquifers. It was because there was just absolutely no kind of effective governance. Nobody was getting them to pay anything, and so they just took it all and figured, well, I'll move to the next place. It was free, and there was a tremendous amount of bribery going on. And so I met these guys who were, you know, in response to public outcries, the government had put in these guys on bicycles who were supposed to go around looking for illegal water hookups. And they told me that the system had been working great, that in the first 6 months they had found 6,000 illegal water hookups and in this Chongqing, and they had fined these factories as much as $500 a piece.
So the system does work after all.
One of the interesting plot lines in 1493, I thought, was the history of currencies on a global level. And currencies are very much a popular topic these days. So one of the things in particular I thought was interesting was China failed both with a fiat and a hard money currency.
Like I said, we're not very good at governing ourselves.
Right? Yeah, you want to talk a little bit about that and about the Colombian change and silver moving around and all these different effects?
China is a place that, the tremendously amazing stuff that sort of poured out of that country. And one of the things they invented way ahead of everybody else was currency, paper money. Dates back at least to about 900, and first paper currency doesn't appear in Europe till the early 17th century, I think it is. And so they have this, and what immediately happens is they invent hyperinflation. You know, what happens is the idea of paper money is, as you know, is great, because the problem with the other kind, where you have lumps of silver around, is that, you know, or gold or whatever you think is valuable, is that sometimes the metal becomes more valuable than the currency, and so people melt it down. And then in addition, you have this problem that most of the time you don't control your own money supply, because people out there are mining gold and silver. And an example of that was that the cowrie shell was a terrific currency in Africa and the Indian Ocean for centuries, until Europeans found a huge source of it outside of the sort of purview of them and brought in, you know, dump truck loads of cowrie shells, and this currency that existed for generation upon generation was blown apart in a couple decades. And so, you know, all of these systems are unsatisfactory. So then you say, well, you don't want to have these things. The ideal thing you want is something that's valueless, it's just a token of value, doesn't have value in itself, that's money. But then governments realize that all they have to do to pay for stuff is print little paper squares and give them to people, and then they will, you know, get all this valuable stuff in return. And so then you invent hyperinflation. So that what ended up happening in China is first the this system broke down, and then they started having coins, but they didn't have enough silver for the coins. And they also had this peculiar rule, only to a government would do this, that when the emperor came in, only coins stamped with his face were valuable. All the old coins no longer were valuable. And so when the emperor died, we started getting sick, what you did is frantically tried to spend all your money before it became became valueless. And then there wouldn't be enough around, so the new emperor would sort of stall on printing it. And people would have these sort of semi-legal coins, and they would vary from place to place. It was a complete mess. And eventually they just gave up and said, we're going to trade lumps of raw silver. And so people would carry around these little ingots of silver, and when you wanted to buy something, they had all these sort of freelance silver weighers. You'd go to the silver weigher, and you'd shave off your little bits of silver, and then he would say, okay, this is 1 ounce of silver, and it's worth whatever it is that you're buying. And then meanwhile, both buyer and seller try to bribe the silversmith to say, oh, this is actually not as pure as you say it is, or that sort of thing. So it was a complete disaster, and all this made the country very vulnerable when Spain in 1545 discovered the world's largest silver strike in southern Bolivia. By the way, that's the most important thing that happened in the Americas for a long time. In southern Bolivia, they discovered this thing, it's like a mountain of pure silver called Potosi. And this vast wash of silver came out of there. A big chunk of it ended up in China, where it became the currency.
Just a quick question. You touched earlier on how bad we are at governing ourselves, but you also mentioned that democracies might be better than not. So I'm wondering if, instead of trying to make more countries into democracies, if the easier problem to solve is to figure out correct pricing for different issues such as water or other constrained resources. Just get your views on it.
The question is, could we somehow do away with government and just have the correct prices for resources? And has anybody ever actually managed to do this in history?
Iceland.
What?
Iceland, Ireland.
What, with no government? There's no government in Iceland or Ireland?
Oh, in history.
Yeah.
Now.
Oh, okay.
But in history, yeah.
Yeah.
No effective government in Iceland.
And
while there was no effective government in Ireland.
And how long did that last? Right.
I thought in Iceland there was the government is a very small community.
Well, I thought Iceland had the oldest parliament.
Exactly. Thingvellir. Well, Ireland had the Brehons. That certainly lasted for hundreds of years. It was robust against the English trying to take it over for quite some time. Actually, it lasted from the Roman times until the English finally conquered Ireland. Iceland, it's a shorter period of time.
They're Dahomey in West Africa. So they're examples of
sort of
anarchy, but they're not
stable. Yeah. It seems like most of the time people sort of fall to having a government. And I guess my feeling about democracy, Winston Churchill's famous remark about democracy, which is it's the worst of all possible political systems except for all the others. And that seems to me the case. So, what is it? William F. Buckley wrote 2 cheers for the market. I sort of feel 1.5 cheers for democracy.
I have the next question. Maybe I'm the only person to ever tell you this, but I read 1491 when I was in labor with my first child.
You are.
Well, I was finishing reading it, and it was so interesting that it kept my interest up and it kept my mind off of all the pain. So, so thank you.
Well, that's the nicest thing that anybody has ever said to me.
But, and you named your child
that. So that's how that child was named that way.
And it's a girl, so that's why it's so puzzling. I wanted to know how long it took you to write each of those books, doing all the research, and how do you set up all the interviews and things before you go? You said you went to China 9 times. How did you find the people that you talked to? And I mean, I know that's a more prosaic question, but it's just, the books are so detailed and fascinating, and you managed to compile a huge amount of really, interesting information plus personal, anecdotes and things. So I just wondered if you could comment on that.
Well, I promise I did not pay her to. No, for me, basically, you just keep asking questions. And, you know, I don't have any assistants. I sort of do everything myself, which is probably stupid. And I kept going until the last trip. I thought, you know, I didn't really learn that much this trip. And so I felt like, okay. And at that point, also, my wife and children were ready to kill me. in answer to how long this is, actually, in 1491, there's a couple sentences that I wrote in the early 80s, so I was thinking of at one point claiming, for my notebooks and stuff, claiming, oh, it took me 20 years and stuff. But in fact, I had, what happened was that in the early 80s, I was writing a story for Science about the ozone layer, and there was this effort by NASA to go up and sample the ozone layer at various places along between the northern and southern hemisphere, and they asked me if I wanted to ride along. I was very excited, of course, who wouldn't want that? And so we landed in Yucatan, and the equipment broke down for some reason. So the scientists and I rented one of those old VW vans you used to have in Mexico, and I went to the Maya ruins, and I was blown away. I just, you know, I'd lived in Italy for a couple years, and these seemed to me, you know, to my untrained eyes, to be just as sophisticated. They're also huge. I couldn't get over how big they were. And the idea that you go to a place like Chichen Itza, and then you walk to the edge, and then there's obviously, you know, just huge amounts of ruins just still going on and on and on. And I thought, this is weird. You know, when I grew up in Highland Junior High School, we learned a little bit about Greece and Rome, which I think we should, but I don't think the word Maya was even mentioned. And, you know, it's my own hemisphere, right? It just seemed weird. And so on my own, I went back, and I used the journalist privilege. I would call up, I would try to, you know, the archaeologists and say, can you tell me about this? I'm from science. And so it happened that, by dumb luck, that this was during this period, this incredible intellectual feat where the archaeologists just deciphered the Maya language, which is amazing. Usually when you decipher written language, there's a crib, you know, there's like the Rosetta Stone. There's another text that you, so you can, you know, match them up. This was just done by pure smarts. It's a really an amazing thing. And so there was this enormous intellectual excitement going on as this, because there's thousands and thousands of written documents. And so they were, you know, and so I wrote about that for Science. And I gradually became aware that other people in other parts of the Americas were finding interesting stuff too. And at a certain point, I thought, geez, somebody should write a book.
Actually, this is for John Tierney. I just wanted to make a comment and a request of John. The comment, as a number of you know, but not all of you, is that John Tierney continues to hold the record for the most hate mail ever sent to the New York Times. For his cover story some dozen or more years ago in the New York Times Magazine called Recycling is Garbage. John, back to Billy's question about energy and whatnot. Why don't you tell us briefly the story of your own Simon Ehrlich-type bet that you made?
You know, back in the 1980s, I heard about Julian Simon betting Paul Ehrlich about things running out. That Paul Ehrlich had been writing these things that we're running out of all these resources, we're hitting the limits to growth, blah, 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 the end of affluence. And the amazing thing is that I just saw in the Science... Is it the current issue or the next one that they're publishing another article by Ehrlich saying, you know, about we can't afford to keep consuming stuff. And, you know, he and John Holdren, Obama's science advisor, joined Ehrlich on this bet. And they picked five metals and said, we're going to run out of these. And 10 years later, just as Julian Simon predicted, they were all cheaper than they'd been at the time of the bet. So Julian was kind of a mentor of mine. And then... In, I think, 2005, the New York Times Magazine had a big story called The Twilight. Twilight in the Desert, but it was the coming Saudi oil collapse. And it was a guy, Matt Simmons, who's an energy...
Really?
Yeah, it was a, he was a, an energy expert, and he said the Saudis had overestimated how much oil was there, that in fact production was going to collapse and it was going to cause a huge problem and oil prices were going to spike.
Peak oil.
That was going to be there. And so when he did it, and you know, and I knew nothing about Saudi oil production at all, knew nothing about fracking or any of these things, but I just, what Julian Simon's advice was, always look at long-term trends. And if someone offers, and if someone tells you that resources are becoming scarcer and more expensive, that's not what's been going on for hundreds, thousands of years, really. Resources get cheaper over time. So he said, if someone wants to bet, take their money. And so I bet him, we bet $5,000. So in 2005 to 2010, and he bet oil was going to be, I think, $200 a barrel.
So he was sincere.
Well, I mean, yeah, it was great publicity for his book, too. I mean, he was smart about that, too. But he genuinely believed it. And, I mean, I had offered him actually the bet that Julian Simon had always recommended. He and Ehrlichman, you know, they made a bet, and they said that the price, Julian said the price of this will be lower in inflation-adjusted terms in the future than it is now. And Julian always said that the really fair bet would be that it will take less labor to buy something in the future. That the only thing that gets more expensive over time is the cost of human labor. That goes up over time. The cost of resources goes down. And it's just such a strange thing to see all this talk about sustainability and that we need to save all these things when this stuff is not important. It's our time that is what's valuable. And the whole point of recycling of garbage is, why are we spending all of our valuable time sorting these materials that are becoming worth less and less every year? And I find it a very anti-humanist message to be teaching our kids that your time is nothing, but this garbage is really important, you know. I was with a science class where they're spending a science class where they could be learning about Newton and Darwin, and they're out picking up garbage and sorting it into piles, and it just struck me as very bizarre.
Entropy gets stuck here, and so that's the question: is do you maximize entropy? I mean, we need more energy. That's clear to increase complexity. But when does the entropy become? Might there not be a? Isn't energy the ultimate currency in the universe? And shouldn't we actually look at energy consumption as the real currency?
I mean, it's not gold, it's not conch shells, it's what's really important is energy consumption.
Well, how much energy we have, you mean?
There's clearly a lot of it.
Right.
There's so much of it that wouldn't we be susceptible to serious inflation problems?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the entropy created by consuming that energy might stay here on Earth.
It seems like, I mean, one rule that I thought from studying the history of ecology and economics is that the idea that you should even plan for more than 50 years ahead seems to me
absolutely. You know,
it's hard to think of anything in the past where somebody 100 years ago could have made a good plan to do anything. I mean, the only thing I can think of is maybe somebody who set aside a national park or a preserve, that if you think in the future, people will be richer and therefore they'll value this more than we do now for something else. But it's hard to think of anything that you would have done 100 years ago that would make any sense. I mean, and certainly energy policies, the stuff from that was done during the energy crisis in the 80s, most of it just turned out to be completely, awful. There was like...
Some of it even worse. Do you know that the Carter administration... One of the things I was completely flabbergasted to learn was that one of the Carter administration's policies was to switch electric power utilities from gas and oil to coal. And these same coal utilities that are now causing, you know, so much anguish are in fact deliberately set into place by laws that were only sunsetted in 1996.
You mentioned fracking a couple of times. Could you talk more about the fracking revolution? There's now a film at Tribeca Film Festival, the second in a series, talking about how fracking is going to contaminate our groundwater. Could you elaborate on those issues?
One of the things that is very important when you talk about fracking is it's a new technology, and there are now dozens and dozens of operators out there changing it and improving it. And so almost anything that you say about the technology now will not hold in 5 years. So that's important to say. For example, one of the objections to fracking is that it uses a lot of water. And in some places where there isn't very much water, it seems like an obvious worry. At the same time, there's numbers of people who are working on methods of injecting other things in there than water, including carbon dioxide. So almost all the environmental objections are to the technology as it's in now, and it's really in its infancy. And so that's a giant caveat that I would say. So the main objections to this are that it uses a lot of water, and I think that is actually being answered. That it contaminates water. There's very equivocal evidence on that. And it doesn't really make that much sense, because typically where you get the natural gas from and where utilities draw water from, they're in very, very different layers of the earth. So there may be some places where they overlap, but typically they're separated by a good deal of the earth. And then the third thing is, and I think this is actually the most important, is that there's nobody who really inspects the pipeline system and the wells to see if they leak methane. And methane has important, burning natural gas is important, climate change type benefits, and they're negated if you leak too much methane, which is a very powerful greenhouse gas. And you typically, if you lose about 3% of the well, that's the sort of rule of thumb, you negate the climate benefits that you supposedly want. And I was flabbergasted to learn how little attention is paid to our natural gas infrastructure system. There's only been one city that's been thoroughly inspected. It's Boston. Then they simply drove white panel vans down the 780 miles of Boston roads sniffing for natural gas leaks, and they found almost 4,000 of them. And that's just ridiculous. It's dangerous. The main thing I worry about, I would like to see on this regard, people driving around inspecting the pipelines and so forth for leaks. I mean, you don't want this flammable stuff just gushing out.
That's really good.